You're listening to the Youth Critic Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at WUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at WUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
Separate your head from your shoulders.
Do it fast.
All right.
The time's wrong.
Woo! No!
You might as well just kill me then, too.
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We'll give him a week, see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes a kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's $3 short for a bus ticket home.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospective. I am your host, Kale Smith. Joining me today is Diego Crespo.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So, Diego, we're not talking about a movie that's celebrating an anniversary per se, or a big special thing, but what movie are we talking about, and why are we talking about it?
We are talking about Kathryn Bigelow's directorial debut, Near Dark, a weird Western vampire romance movie that I love very much.
Yep, and really that's why we're talking. We're making an excuse to talk about Near Dark, and also it's close to Halloween, so, and Near Dark is kind of horror-ish.
Oh, it was the 31st anniversary at the time of this recording yesterday.
Gotcha.
So there you go. There's your anniversary.
Cool. So we're just kind of talking about it because it's a kind of a cool movie. It's one of Kathryn Bigelow, who is like a huge director for anyone that doesn't know. I mean, The Hurt Locker, Point Blank, Strange Days. She recently did Detroit. What was that movie with Bin Laden?
Zero Dark Thirty.
Yes.
And The Hurt Locker, K-19 and The Widowmaker.
Mm-hmm.
She's an incredible director. I have not seen Detroit. I think I'm gonna skip that one, if I'm being honest, because I'm kind of tired of white liberal approach to racism. And I love Kathryn Bigelow dearly, but that one I'm going to skip. But she's a fantastic director, and I really want her to go back to doing stuff like this. I'm kind of tired of her documentary-style war movies.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I am too. And she really hasn't done anything like this in a while. Like, I think Strange Days was like her last genre fare, or is K-19 considered an action?
I actually haven't seen K-19. That's my blind spot. But Strange Days, I think, was the last one, and that bombed like hard. It made like $8 million against $45 million budget. So that must have been brutal. I think that might have shied her away from it a little bit, which is too bad because she's really good at it. Strange Days is a masterpiece.
And what's even more surprising is she co-wrote and produced that with James Cameron.
That's right.
So it's even weirder that but I mean, that's kind of Kathryn Bigelow's kind of story, is that she kind of makes movies that, you know, that people don't really know how to market. I mean, I guess up until recently, like with Zero Dark Thirty, you can kind of promote, this is a true story, and then Detroit, same thing. But really, and one of the things I found in my research is not a lot of people kind of knew or really cared how to market Near Dark, which is the ultimate reason why it couldn't even gross its $5 million budget back.
I actually know the full story about that, if I may divulge.
Go ahead.
Okay, so Dino De Laurentiis was a really harsh producer back in the 1980s. I did a Hannibal Lecter retrospective series, and he produced the first film in that unofficial franchise, Manhunter, which also did not do great. It did about as bad as Near Dark for both of their respective budgets. because he doesn't know how to really like share the movies he makes. I don't think he understood like how to promote the sort of movies that he was making along the way, at least most of the time. But even worse so than the situation with Manhunter, Dino De Laurentiis went bankrupt. The De Laurentiis group went bankrupt. And so the very first promotional material for Near Dark was an ad about the size of a business card. That was the first like promotional launch. And when you start promoting a movie, you got to come swinging out the gate. We see problems with stuff like basically every Spider-Man movie nowadays overmarkets the shit out of itself. Near Dark had the opposite problem, where it just physically could not be promoted because there was no money. And so even with like half the cast of Aliens in starring roles, it just there was no one to grab hold of it. And not only that, after the success of Fright Night and The Lost Boys, vampires were both a hit, but also kind of hard to sell if they weren't a big, if they didn't have a big marketing push either. So The Lost Boys came out a couple months before this, and I think they were shot like at the same time though. It was just like a
They were literally shot in like fall winter of 1986, early 1987. And they both came out like within weeks of each other. Like, I think Lost Boys came out in mid-August of 87, and then this one came out October 2nd, 10th. According 10th.
I think it had its premiere the 2nd.
Okay. So
that might be a mistake on my part.
I mean, Wikipedia says the 2nd, but...
Wikipedia, you son of a bitch.
But I didn't check IMDb just to cross-reference, cross-check. But yeah, I mean, it, so October 10th and yeah, I mean, it was literally like within weeks of each other. So I think Lost Boys may or may not have still been in some theaters at that time. So, and they were both very similarly plotted.
I think that's just a vampire thing though, you know, cause the whole vampire mythology is like, oh, it's, every vampire movie has to be a little seductive, like a little sexy, except unless you're making like Nosferatu or some shit. That's not a sexy movie. That's just a scary movie.
And you're talking about Werner Herzog's Nosferatu, right?
I was talking about the original F.W. Murnau. Who's the director? I don't know. Some fucking old dead guy who was really good at making movies.
Yeah.
yeah, F.W. Murnau's original Nosferatu, which... for a long time was my favorite vampire movie because that scared the shit out of me. But like the OG vampires were always about like the rich, like sucking the life out of the common folk, which is like literally what happens in the real world. It's just not as like opaque. And I think it's really interesting that Near Dark is kind of the unofficial like evolution of that. You know, because we don't see the big city stuff. We don't see the fancy folk. Like, we don't see a Count Dracula or a Count Orlok, you know? These are just, like, the remnants of society who have been outcast as vampires. Like, this might as well take place in, like, the 1920s Dust Bowl in Midwest America, because it's just vast, empty plains with some life here and there. Most of the people that show up die. But it's so, like, different for a vampire movie, and as such it is my favorite vampire movie actually.
Yeah, so Diego, so my thing with vampire movies are that they usually don't quite work with me because they're never scary, or they like, I don't find the vampire mythology as much as scary, but as much as like I'm trying like a sexual fantasy. Like, what's another word for... Like, it feels...
Sexual fantasy, I think, is appropriate, especially nowadays, like, in the post-Twilight age, where, I mean, there is something inherently seductive about them. Like, the biting on the neck is clearly, like... is clearly a sexual, like, act.
Right.
It's just very... It is the worst version of that act in vampire mythology, because you either... contract some disease in right. vampirism, or you die. Like, those are the only two options, really.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's basically the Freudian term of penetration, which kind of becomes interesting here because of what because and this is where I kind of draw the comparisons very much, you know, more comparison to Lost Boys and Near Dark. I won't do this too much, but the both movies are about young men being lured into a small outcasted society of like gypsy anarchists who, you know, wreak havoc in their, you know, either their small town or for Lost Boys, like LA or a small part of, you know, Southern California. And they both are looking for, and both male antagonists are looking for like a cure or a way out of their suffering from being lured into and penetrated by this group. So it's, so I know it's loot. I know, but I think Near Dark does it better. I think Near Dark does it better because Catherine Bigelow, what she does brilliantly here is she immerses us into this group. Like each character has their own characterization.
Yeah, that's something I really loved, and I love The Lost Boys. It doesn't even touch like Near Dark. There's no world where that's true. Like some people will say that, and you are entitled to that wrong opinion.
I don't remember any of the other Lost Boys other than Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah, like it's a flashy, fun, seductive vampire movie that's very 80s. This could take place in any time period that is not present day. This could be a post-apocalyptic fairy tale. There you go. And it would make just as much sense.
Well, and it helps that, you know, not much has changed in the Midwest as much as, like, development. So, I mean, you really could set this in any kind of time period. I think, I mean, they probably set this in modern time just because it was, like, the cheapest way to go. But yeah, I mean, you can set this in any time period and it would not matter because it's, you know, it just still has all the traits of the Western, but also, you know, it's loosely has the traits of a vampire movie. It cuts the gothic part of it and kind of leads, you know, kind of the modern, postmodern-esque to it.
Yeah, it really does. And it doesn't feel like a vampire movie because originally Catherine Bigelow and Eric Red, they were trying to write a Western at the time. After her directorial debut, The Loveless, she had a co-director on that. I don't remember who it was, but they didn't work together again. But Eric Red and Catherine Bigelow worked together multiple times. And they wrote two things on spec back to back. One was called a movie called Undertow, which was eventually released on television in 1996, and Near Dark. But they were trying to make a Western at the time, and another producer came to them and said, hey, like, those aren't really selling right now, so you got to add, like, a genre element to it, maybe something horror. And so they made a vampire movie, and they took out all, like, the classic gothic stuff with the crosses and the onions and holy water, and they just made it – they blended it with Western tropes and, like, iconography.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, they kind of just – pick and choose the rules, and it's still, and it works very well. I mean, you can make an argument that the blood transfusions at the end doesn't, it's a little too simplified, a little too simple of a cure, but
it's very simplified, but I still think it actually works. I guess I'll get into that right now really quick. For a weird little genre movie like this, they kind of try out like every little possible idea you could have. You know, it's like, all right, he's just taken over by the vampires. They're going to eat him? No. All right. Well, he's got to kind of join their cause, right? Yep. And so they try like all these weird different little scenarios and like set pieces to like test and show us the group dynamics of all this stuff. And by the end of the movie, it's only like an hour and a half movie. It's not even like long at all. I kind of wish it was longer just because I like living in this world. But I don't think there's anyone who can come away from this movie being like, well, I wish they'd kind of done this too, or done this too. Because, like, if you really add anything else to this story, you're going to overstuff it. It's simple. But it's filled with, like, this really beautiful character stuff, you know? And so by the end, maybe it is a little cheat to do a blood transfusion to change out the vampiric disease. But for something that's really stripped down, like, it still plays like a fantasy almost, but it's stripped down in its more fantastical elements. Like, ultimately, it's a story about day versus night. Like, Caleb, the main character, has his father of the day and his real biological father, and his father of the night, and Jesse Hooker, who's played by the fucking incredible Lance Henriksen, who's so good in this. All the vampires are amazing in this. Like, Bill Paxton, Jeanette Goldstein, the kid who plays Homer, like, oh my God, Jennifer Wright as May. I cannot believe how well this movie's cast. But anyway, I'll finish my point really quick. I think the blood transfusion ultimately works because, as simple as one thing, they just set it up earlier in the movie. Like, that's it. Like, there's like a line of dialogue where they talk about, like, all the material they use for, like, transfusing the animals that him and his dad look over back on the farm or something like that. And it's simple setup and payoff. It's probably the weakest point of the movie, but then the rest of the movie picks up again, so it's, like, totally fine.
Well, the reason why, to me, the blood transfusion still works is because it's a symbolic way of, you know, of, because the whole movie's about, you know, venturing out into the unknown, venturing out into, you know, it's about venturing out into basically the wilderness and, like, the first exploration of being out on your own. And for him and for the character of Caleb, he's out on his own. And of course he's, you know, carrying, you know, his, you know, sort of bravado macho physique. And of course, when he's introduced into the whole vampire world, he kind of wants out of it as soon as possible. And symbolically, the way he gets out of it is to go back home, to go back to the safety of home and the comfort of his, you know, of his father and his sister. So essentially the whole story is about basically just like this dude just having a really bad like time, you know, just venturing out into the world and just getting like caught up in the wrong group of people, much like how you're being caught in, like, you know, in a world full of people of drug abusers, and then when you go home and you do rehab, you're doing okay afterwards.
Yeah, there's heavy comparison allusions to addicts in this movie. Like when Caleb first gets bitten, he's just wandering around like sweaty, pale. He looks like half dead, and it's like hard to watch at times.
And even the cop that's at the bus station is like, looks at him like he's a meth addict.
Yeah. But that's a good point about the blood transfusion being more symbolic about his return home, like his cleansing, you know?
Right.
And his rehab. Yeah. Because I guess like the rest of the movie is also kind of about not just like exploring the world for the first time, but his early dialogue when he goes to meet up with his friends is about him being like they want to get out of here, you know, they're just small town kids, like there's nothing here for them, you know.
Yeah, it's a gas station that might have like a pizza place in it, and that's it. And he's in this old beat up truck that's fallen apart, that breaks down in the middle of a road.
Yeah, and he has this great line of dialogue, like, what does he say, like, wish I may, wish I might, wish I were far from here tonight, or something like that. And, like, yeah. The dialogue in this movie is just, a lot of the actors, when they talk about it, they keep referring to it as, like, the script read like poetry. And I've read the script, and it's totally, like, minimalist in its, like, presentation. Like, there's never a line that doesn't need to be said. And there's never a line of dialogue or character exchange that overstays its welcome.
Right.
So it's almost like bare minimum, but it's filled with history and richness, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, and it helps that, you know, that Bigelow really wanted to emphasize on visuals, much like what was her targeted thing before, or what she was used to as an artist before. So it helped that, you know, so I think she really leaned more when she co-wrote the script with Red to basically lean in on the visual language of the movie, the cinema techniques, and trust in actors to basically give characterization without expository. I've been having trouble with that.
No, it's a fucking weird word. Fuck exposition words.
Yes.
Exposition sucks so much. Even the words exposition suck.
I don't know why I'm having trouble. Usually I have good time or a fine time saying it. So the word.
Yeah, the word. You know,
when you don't have to, basically what I'm trying to say is these characters don't have to be characterized through dialogue, or they don't have to say who they are. They don't have to talk about what they are. You see it in their characterizations. You see that Bill Paxton is basically the wild card, you know, the more anarchist of the group. And he, you know, and you see, you know, and you see Homer is the, you know, guy who's like, you know, in his 60s, but he's still in like a 12-year-old body. And then you have, you know, the Jeanette Goldstein, who's the maternal figure of the family. And then you have Jesse Hooker, who is the, you know, paternal and outlooker. Like, he's the one that's been doing this the longest out of everyone. And then you have May and Caleb just roped into this.
I love the weird histories that they all have. Like, you can kind of tell, like, what time periods they're all from, almost. Like, they all, whether it was in the script or not, a lot of it wasn't in the script. They came up with a lot of it, like, with Catherine Bigelow, and they, like, bounced ideas off for the vampire cast. But, like, Jesse Hooker, he's from the Civil War, obviously, right? And he says, like, you know, he fought for the South and he lost. Then on the inside of his coat is stitched the Confederate flag. And it's just little things like that. Like, you either notice it or you don't, but it really adds to the performance and the movie if you do. And, like, how Bill Paxton's, like, he has no, like, everyone kind of has, like, their own inner battle going on with, like, their vampirism and, like, how it's all cool and exciting. But then, like, daylight comes and, like, fuck, man, like, we got to do this again. Like it almost, like, weighs down on them. But Bill Paxton, with, like, the exception of having to be asleep during the day, he's like, fuck yeah, like, I'm a vampire. I'm just going to wreck shit, you know? Like, that's so fascinating to me.
Because, I mean, as long as he stays away from fire and sunlight, he's okay. He'll live forever.
Yeah. And he's the only one that, like, loves it. And I really love Jenny Wright's character of May, because she's the only one that isn't, like, a full-on, like, psychopath. But she's also got, like, this she's also got her own way of luring people in. Like, they're all just flat-out murderers. And they, like, they kind of play with their food. She kind of does, too, at one point. Like, we see her at the bar when she's slow dancing with the guy. And then she's like, she tells Caleb, go get him. But, like, you kind of see her methods throughout the movie. When she lures in Caleb, she's eating a snow cone just out in the middle of the streets. And she's the calm one. She's the more nurturing one, I think, apart from Diamondback. Jeanette Goldstein's character. Yeah, Diamondback's not really nurturing. You see her, like, on occasion be like that, like, when sunlight starts pouring into the motel room and she, like, calms Homer down, the young old man.
Yeah.
But it's really May who still has her humanity, her kindness, you know, and Caleb, even though he was going to be a victim, she ends up not killing him because I think part of her wants that humanity back again by that point, you know? And well, so it's almost as much her journey as much as it is Caleb's. She just doesn't know how to achieve that yet.
Well, I mean, she's kind of at a halfway point in terms of her, you know, in her vampirism, and that she still because she's only been doing this in terms of the movie. She's only been doing it for a few years. So yeah. She, you know, so for her, you know, she still remembers. She still kind of remembers the bits and pieces of her humanity. And she kind of holds on to it. And, you know, when she's with Caleb for that little bit of time at the opening of the movie, you know, their playfulness kind of reminded her of that. It reminded her of, you know, of being young and being, you know, in the moment of love and being caught in, you know, in the affections of it all. So for her, like, you know, she stops biting Caleb the moment he feels the bite, because, you know, it's, she doesn't want that moment to end, but now she's, you know, she's now bitten him. So of course she's got to deal with it.
Yeah. And then in their own weird way, the vampire family, they do care about one another very dearly. And they'll have like honest talks with one another. Like they never lie to one another. If you notice that, they never go against one another for more than like a moment, because they're a family. Mm-hmm. They're terrible, terrible people. But oh, they're a yes. family.
They're very terrible people.
Yeah, like they straight up, they're, the big confrontation with Caleb and May isn't so much that she turned him, it's that now that he has to pull his weight around at a certain point. At first they're like, yeah, you idiot, now we gotta like kill this guy before anyone finds out. And then once you get past that point, the problem is just that Caleb is leaning on May for support, and they're like, that's not right, you know.
And yeah,
like, that's, in hindsight, that's kind of like hilarious that that's the problem with this entire situation for them. It's like, hey, he's got to pull his weight too.
Well,
nothing else.
But there's a good point to that, because, I mean, she just can't, like, she can't physically do this for the rest of eternity.
Oh, no, yeah, for sure. But then, I mean, just the situation of them being, like, vampires and murdering people. It was like, all that's fine. It's just like, hey, he's not pulling his weight around here. Tell him to pick himself up by his bootstraps.
Yeah, it's a very much like, it's very much like, you know, this, like, I lost it, but it's very much like this, it's very much like this outlook of, you know, once you're with us, you gotta, you know, pick up the weight, you gotta, you know, pick up the mop and start mopping the floors. It's like the moment you start working, it's like, you know, that's fine. It's great that you're getting paid, but you actually have to do something for it. Yeah. So, but in a logical sense, it all works. Like it all makes sense, because, you know, you can even see it in the scene, like in the second scene where he's just sucking on her, that it's literally taking an effect on her, that he's sucking her blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's going through her still. And like, they're dead, but they still need like something to survive. And I thought that was like, super fascinating. I can tell where True Blood got a lot more of its ideas now from. And Twilight.
A lot of movies are inspired by this. Yeah. A lot of stuff is, which is so odd.
Because it didn't make any money. It's like, but everyone who finds out about it after is like, hey, that was pretty dang good.
Yeah, and on top, well, the reason, not only did it not make any money, but I mean, it's that it's not like readily available.
No, yeah, it's crazy hard to track down. Like, Lionsgate had to distribute it, because there was no Dino De Laurentiis group to distribute it at this point, I don't think. I think they went under for a couple years and they came back or something like that, or they had to like lay low, but they definitely couldn't distribute a fucking movie on DVD or Blu-ray. And both the transfers are terrible. I have the DVD, I have the Blu-ray. The awful transfers that do not do service to Adam Greenberg's incredible cinematography. For those who don't know, Adam Greenberg shot both the original Terminator and Terminator 2. His last movie was Snakes on a Plane. But Near Dark was, according to Kathryn Bigelow, the last movie that he operated the camera and lit himself. And you could tell that Adam Greenberg shot this if you've seen the first Terminator, because the nighttime sequences look exactly the same. And that is not a criticism. He does stunning photography at night. He's also gone on record as saying that he loves working at night more, even though it tends to be more like stressful, because you know, people are meant to be asleep at night. It's, well, you could be, yeah. Everyone was totally game for this movie, but even like at a certain point in interviews, you could see that like the nighttime took like a toll on them. But he likes working at night because you have more control over your environments more. You could tell where the light's going to come. You don't have to make compromises like during the day, which if you shoot outdoors and not on sets can be very stressful.
Well, I mean, that's just filmmaking in general. Like if you can control the lighting, you can really, you know, come up with some really cool shit. Like that's why a lot of movies look very good at night versus in the day. I mean, there's some great movies that are shot in the day, but still a lot of great movies are shot, look fantastic at night because someone like Adam Greenberg can come in and make it just look visually appealing.
Yeah. There's something about the way he shoots streets, whether the, like he's really good at shooting empty streets with the wet pavement. Like it's a classic like thing people use for texture just to make the nighttime a little more lively.
It's a cool magic trick.
To like, yeah, to Walter Hill and Michael Mann. They used to do that a lot with their Michael Mann still fucking does it. But Adam Greenberg makes it look just like stunning and romantic. It's a very romantic movie. Like there'll be just sequences where Caleb and May are just talking to one another, looking up at the night sky, and it with Tangerine Dream score like swelling in the background, and it's a beautiful movie, like inside and out.
Oh yeah, very beautiful. And let's segue into. Do you want to segue to Tangerine Dream?
Oh fuck yeah.
So I love the score for this movie. It's action when it needs, it's perfect action synth when it needs to be, but you know, the love theme, but or I guess May's theme, when you brought it up, like, you know, when Caleb and May are just sitting, you know, in the empty industrial field, just talking and looking at the stars. It looks, it sounds incredible. It works with the images that's happening on screen.
Yeah, it's like the perfect score. Like, just the perfect movie score. Because it doesn't overbear on anything. It just builds upon what's already there. And you get caught up in the moments with them. Because by the midpoint of the movie, Caleb's like, totally forgot about escaping the vampires. He has nowhere else to go, right? Because he can't survive without the vampirism.
Well, he doesn't know any other way.
Yeah, yeah. But you kind of forget about going back to his home life just like he did, and the music helps like push you along that way because it's very romantic. And then immediately once the Caleb's family is brought back into things, the music gets very tense, and there's like this weird like synthy bass string that kind of like amps up the tension in a motel room. And you're right, the action, the score for the action is crazy good. By itself, it kind of sounds a little weird, but like that doesn't matter because it's a movie score, you know?
Right. Well, and, I mean, it works with the
stunning.
Yeah, it is a little weird, but it works with what you're seeing because it's edited so perfectly. It's synced very perfectly with what's going on.
Yeah. Tangerine Dream also scored Michael Mann's Beef and William Friedkin's Sorcerer. They are an incredible German electronic group that don't really score movies anymore. I think they scored something recently, but I don't know. Oh, Grand Theft Auto 5, which has a very good score. And they also did a remix of the Stranger Things theme, which is pretty cool. Everyone should go check that out.
It is. But, it's very good.
And I want them to do more weird genre stuff. They should re-team with Catherine Bigelow and do just a weird $5 million budget movie.
Like Near Dark?
Like Near Dark, yeah. It doesn't need to be vampires, maybe werewolves. There needs to be more werewolf stuff, I think. I don't know. Zombies. Bet you make a killer zombie movie.
Yeah. Never mind. I was about to say the zombie genre, but that's getting played out too much right now. So, but yeah. I wish they would do more stuff. I was hoping with Suspiria that they would, like, Luca Guadagnino would go to them, to like Tangerine Dream, Like, that pairing would have worked so well.
Oh, that would have been great. But Radiohead ain't no slack.
Yeah, yeah. Thom Yorke is pretty good, so we'll stick with that. You know, that's not like a bad downgrade.
Yeah, no, at all. Not at all.
But yeah, that's what I hope. I hope more stuff like, you know, Radiohead and Tangerine Dream, they get to do more scores, because especially now that, you know, synth is kind of coming back, because everyone's all like nostalgic over 80s stuff.
Yeah, I think that's going to get burnt out pretty soon, because I just watched the summer of 84 and I'm like, oh, we're tapping out of that now. Okay, I see.
Oh, yeah. Summer of 84.
That's a real bad movie.
Yeah, it is.
But I want that industrial synth stuff to kind of stick around, because it does add something different that you don't see in a lot of movies. Like Doctor Strange almost kind of has it during the end credits scenes. I'm like, hey, that's kind of neat, you know? And like, I want movies to just do whatever they need to be the best version of themselves, you know?
Right.
And Near Dark is clearly the best version of itself. It's big and romantic, and it's not very scary, but there's a lot of great, like, body effects at points and stuff. Like when Caleb gets shot in the gut, and the squibs, like, actually impacted Adrian Pasdar, like, at the wrong time when he was breathing. So when he's, like, struggling to breathe, that's, like, that's really him struggling to breathe from the pressure of the squibs.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks fucking great.
But I wanted to ask you, so why do you... Maybe we cover this already, but why do you think it's still... There's this big problem of, like, releasing it commercially.
The money wasn't there when it was released. It wasn't made for very much, but it also didn't make very much. The original production company still struggling to make things financially successful. The Dino De Laurentiis group, or I guess the who is it? De Laurentiis Entertainment Group, they're not very active. And I was right. They were defunct in 1989. And I think now they just have, like, rights to stuff that you kind of got to work out for a while. So it's not readily available because there's no one to distribute it. I think Lionsgate had to distribute the DVD and the Blu-ray eventually. And so there's just no one to support it. And it never really has taken off, like, even in cult circles, you know, like we talk to people that are pretty into, like, low budget cult films pretty often, especially in our film circles. But so many people still just don't know about Near Dark. It never found a huge audience. It's finding more people now than ever before, but
yeah, you know,
it's difficult to track down.
It was. I mean, there's no good print released of the movie, or good, like, Blu-ray or DVD of. It's kind of, like, gone into, like, the original Dawn of the Dead territory, because that movie also has, like, not had a commercially released updated version in, like, 10 years.
Yeah. But shout out to the New Beverly. They had a 35 millimeter print of it back. This was tragically right after Bill Paxton passed away. And Adrian Pasdar came to present the film and have a discussion after. I missed this, unfortunately, and I will never forgive myself.
You bastard.
But the fact that it's at least still out there and it's not been, like, destroyed, like possibly the original prints of Star Wars have, that bodes well for something hopefully in the future. It is available on Netflix in the UK, Mexico, Brazil, Ireland, Peru, Panama, Costa Rica, Bahamas, places like basically everywhere that's not America. And this feels like a very American take on the vampire mythology. So that's odd to me.
It is.
Frustrating. I really want someone like Arrow or Shout Factory. I forget their names, but they're really good. Shout Factory is very good with their releases. I think they just did the Suspiria 4K re-release, right?
A year ago, yes.
Yeah, and that thing just is wow. It looks like it was projected instead of being played on a 4K player. Like, that thing looks remarkable. And if Near Dark got a treatment that was half as good as that, I would be very happy. I'd be content entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw the Suspiria 4K remaster at the Plaza last year. I actually saw it on the same night I saw Mother, which is one of other favorite movies of 2017.
No, but go on.
but when I saw it, I mean, it looked like it was just shot like 2 days ago. Like, I mean, it, in a good way. Like, it didn't look like, you know, it didn't have that film grain that, you know, happens every, that generation lost film grain. It looked incredibly well done. So I hope, and actually, and I promise this is a good thing, I tweeted out to Shout Factory yesterday asking, hey, Shout Factory, when is there going to be a Shout release of Near Dark? And they responded to me during this afternoon saying, good one, we don't have the rights at this time, but you never know.
Nice.
So,
my God, if they got the rights, I want to know what I need to do to make that happen. I want to know who I have to kill.
I'll
probably do it.
Well, I mean, you'll probably have to track down the De Laurentiis group.
I'm just trying to make Cannibal come back. So I got to track down Brian Fuller. Got it.
Okay. Yes. And then track down Lionsgate. Because you said Lionsgate was the last like people to have the rights.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, so because they distributed the home release in the post-2000s. So, yep, they got it.
All right.
Oh, and if you've seen the cover of the DVD, it's so bad. Because it was at the height of Twilight. So it was not that I have anything against Twilight. I'm just using point of comparison. I want to make that clear too, because I think Twilight gets a bad rap. It looks very like photoshopped with Caleb and May holding each other on the cover, and it looks like a Twilight ripoff, but like from the mid 2000s CW. I'm a CW fan, but there's something about that era of CW that was just like.
Too cheap.
Oh, yeah. Like, real tacky. It's a real tacky cover, and it looks awful. It's too bad, because this is anything but a tacky movie. This is a movie made with a great cast, great filmmakers, great technicians, and a whole lot of love. Like, you could tell that this movie was made for very little, but the budget was cheap, but the filmmaking wasn't. There you go.
It's a miracle what can happen when you have great people behind a project of any sizable budget.
Yeah, and one more thing on an HD release, like a 4K release, that would be amazing. I'll take a quality Blu-ray. I'm not even asking for 4K at this point. But Adam Greenberg's other most popular projects, Terminator and Terminator 2, got 4K releases. And even the digital rentals like were upgraded. I remember because I rented the Terminator to see how it looked digitally. And it's just, like, on my computer screen, it looked, like, impeccable. It looked amazing. And it still has, like, that film grain from... That's because the way they shot it, though. Terminator 2 has, like, none, because that wasn't what they were going for. And
well, they had a budget that time.
Yeah, well, I kind of like a little film grain on my older movies, depending on what movie it is. And I think Terminator and Near Dark kind of need that for the texture of their world, you know, especially the nighttime sequences. Mm-hmm. Something about the way the pavement just glistens like that, it adds like a whole other layer of atmosphere to me. Mm-hmm. So like I'd really like to see this with that kind of upgrade. That might be asking for too much again. But those are like the best ones around right now.
Yeah. Speaking of Adam Greenberg, did you know that he was at one point going to do Captain America Winter Soldier?
What the no, I did not know that. Are you sure?
It was on IMDb listed that he was going to do it for like a long time. And then I think like after shooting, they updated it to Trenoplock, who now does all the Marvel Russo brother movies,
which I have feelings about.
We'll save those feelings for later.
he's bad. There you go. That's my feeling.
But yeah, Adam Greenberg was at one point going to do it. And then I don't know if it was like before shooting, they changed it or what, but I mean, for the longest time, Adam Greenberg was the guy that was going to do it, do Captain America Winter Soldier. or he was listed as.
That's funky. I don't know if I even late or even early Adam Greenberg. I don't know if he'd be my pick for that. His stuff is a little more romantic than I think the Russos are capable of. That nothing against when they work, but that's so weird. I can't even imagine. That's like Roger Deakins working with Michael Bay. Like that just doesn't that doesn't compute in my brain, you know.
But you know you would pay to see that.
Oh yeah, totally. It would be like incomprehensible, but I'd love it.
Oh yeah.
Like I think the Russos need to work with someone who can like help them scale their color palette a little better, because you can see them in like Infinity War kind of stretching their creative muscles a little bit once in a while, but Trent Opelock, the way he shoots stuff and he lights it, everything just kind of blends together, and I kind of don't like that with my superhero movies. So
I don't care for it for my superhero movies, but when it's something like Neil Blomkamp's stuff, it works.
It works pretty good there, especially yeah. District 9. You know what? I will give him credit for The Winter Soldier. I think that movie is shot how it needs to be shot. Everything else after that, I don't know why they kept him around. I'm baffled at the creative decisions the Russos make, though. So I'm out of my depth there now.
I mean, I'm baffled by some of the cinematography choices or cinematographer choices they've made since, like, since hiring, you know, Matthew Libatique for the Iron Man movies and Harris, whoever did Thor. And I mean, they definitely downgraded since then, since like the phase one.
Yeah, phase one has remarkable cinematography. Adam Greenberg, you know what? Adam Greenberg would have been a great DP for the first Captain America.
Probably. I still like Shelley Johnson, what he brought.
No, I do too, but like, because that movie is more, it's the most romantic of the Captain America movies. The other ones are really bogged down by a lot of plot stuff, for better and for worse, but the first Captain America movie is very sweeping and swashbuckly, and it takes time to romanticize its hero a little bit. And Adam Greenberg, I think, could have captured that really well. It also should have been shot on film, but I'll stop now.
Well, most of these movies need to be shot on film still.
Specifically that one. This is a personal preference, but if you're shooting a period piece, I think you need to shoot on film.
Yeah.
I could be convinced otherwise, but that's my personal preference.
Like, right. I mean, look, I mean, digital these days is looking really good. I mean,
love digital. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think there's just something about film. There's just something about film that, you know, it needs to be used, you know, in period pieces. I know digital, it's a lot easier. It's a lot more, you can streamline a lot quicker. But period pieces kind of need, you know, that film aesthetic. So yeah, just stick to digital for the new stuff. And film can be used for, you know, either period pieces or, you know, for directors like Abrams, Nolan, Tarantino, all that.
Yeah, like basically, I just want both to be available. Like,
oh, of course,
as often as possible. I think Zero Dark Thirty, to bring it back to Catherine Bigelow and Near Dark, Zero Dark Thirty was shot digital, but they printed it on for 35 and presented it that way in a lot of places. And the DP on that, I think, is Greg Fraser.
Greg Fraser,
who ended up doing like Rogue One. Another great DP, who was able to capture a very similar vibe, I think, to Near Dark in terms of like the genre weirdness, but still able to capture like the texture of the world and like the colors pop, but not in a way that's like intrusive while still feeling grounded. Like his Rogue One work is really out of this world, like literally out of this world.
It's the best cinematography that we've seen out of these newer ones, in my opinion. I mean, I like Solo and all these other movies, but I think that's the one that feels like if there was to be like an award given, that would be the one to give it to.
Last Jedi and Rogue One are tired for me. But just to keep it Catherine Bigelow, if she does another weird genre movie soon, which she should because she's so talented and I really like her to stretch her genre muscles again. Bring Greg Fraser, because they work really well together.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I really do hope, because it's kind of sad, because I, even after watching Point Break earlier this year, I thought, she's really, the thing I love about Bigelow the most is how she immerses us into the worlds of these characters. It's not just the characterizations of these characters that are interesting, but it's the world that she surrounds them in. Her, how she develops the world of surfing, or the world of, you know, three army dudes in Afghanistan. Like, they're both compelling in their own naturalistic way without having to do expository or she uses that show no tell method so brilliantly.
Yeah, she's really one of our great filmmakers, not just action filmmakers, but like across the board. Yeah. And whenever someone says a female filmmaker that you'll recommend, everyone goes to Kathryn Bigelow because she's probably the most popular until Ava DuVernay and Patty Jenkins started breaking out recently. Rightfully so.
Yes.
And I would argue that Kathryn Bigelow is rightfully so the most popular one. Even though I also think that we should be highlighting more than just her, but there's a reason why she's so popular. She's the shit. She's crazy talented. And oh my God, I'm on IMDb and I was looking up Greg Fraser credits. I just found out that he's shooting The Mandalorian, the new Star Wars show.
Nice.
So now that's my most anticipated thing in the history of ever.
Oh, damn it. I'm going to have to get another streaming service.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Never mind. I'm not watching it anymore.
Oh, come on.
I forgot about that. I'll borrow someone's password.
Okay.
I'm not made of money. I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah, that's true. At least you're not in New York.
I don't know what's worse. You don't need a car in New York. That's the thing. So New York might be a little better just because of that.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I'm just complaining about my life now.
Even though you live in beautiful, sunny Los Angeles.
It's definitely Los Angeles.
Well, I mean, every now and then I hear about the smog, but still.
Yeah.
But that's something that's probably out of your control.
Yeah, tragically.
Yeah. So is there anything else to say about Near Dark? Because I think we've said a lot about the movie, and there's not really much more I can add without going on multiple tangents.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot to say about Near Dark forever and always, because again, it's my favorite vampire movie, but nothing that I could quickly excise from my system. I love Near Dark. I love the way it frames light against the darkness. I love the way they shot the sunsets and the sunrise at dusk. I love the way the streets are lit up romantically with the lights hovering in the background softly as May and Caleb kiss. I love the way the characters interact with one another. I love the uncertain ending where May is human again, but there's almost this moment in the final shot where she's unsure of whether or not she even deserves to be human again. It is a perfect film. I love it dearly, and I will keep tweeting at weird Twitter accounts to upgrade the fucking Blu-ray release.
Please do, because it's the cheapest print DVD or Blu-ray right now is $50. It's outrageous to pay for a Near Dark copy of this movie.
Yeah, it's improbable.
Yeah. And really, that's the only probably good way that the cult following will grow is if one day someone releases a Blu-ray or 4K remaster. But you're right, though, going back to that ending, it's kind of going back to that addiction allegory or drug addict allegory in that, you know, she's probably looking at, you know, the full scale of things now that she's human and rehabilitated. And she's looking back at all the things that she's done, and she probably has that guilt. now that, you know, she's back to being her. So it's a good ending to build, to leave on, because you see Caleb, like, he's all pure and nice, pure and happy. And she's like, I have killed multiple people. I got to sit and think this through now that I'm, you know, normal again.
Yeah, the weight of those decisions must, like, I'm glad there's no sequel. For fun, Eric Red came up with, like, a 25-page treatment. I think it was for, like, Bloody Disgusting or someone like that. It was just a fun Halloween thing. Mm-hmm. And there's, even with that lingering question, there's no more story to tell with Caleb and May. And so I'm glad that it ends on such a...
Well, the story a is different over. Note.
Yeah, the story's over. The story's over. Their story is over. I'm very glad about that. And that ending is just, oh, it's perfect.
I mean, it's ambiguous enough to where you can imagine a very happy ending. They just, you know, live on the ranch and just kind of try and forget about everything. And move on, you know. Or you can be a cynic and be like, you know, or you can be a cynic and she kills herself over the guilt of killing
multiple
people.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting that. Holy shit.
Yeah. either way works. But, yeah. But, yeah. So, I really love Near Dark. It's, and I'm actually happy you brought this up. I saw the movie a year ago for the first time, but I'm glad you brought it up however many times on Twitter, because
I still bring it up too many times on Twitter.
Yeah, well, that and Manhunter, and I still gotta watch Fright Night. That's still on the list. Still on the list. But I saw Near Dark, and I'm glad, because for the longest time I thought her first movie was Blue Steel. So to find this and be like, oh my god, Kathryn Bigelow did a vampire movie. Like, I gotta watch this. So this was an interesting treat a year ago watching, and then rewatching it last night, you know, just being absorbed into the flavors of it. Just greatness.
Oh, I'm happy to have shared this with you.
Thank you. Well, thank you. So with that, are you ready to plug Twitter and whatnot?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at DEGGOWaffles. Follow the Waffle Press, where I post a bunch of retrospectives and roundtable discussions with my other co-hosts. And check out Talk Film Society, where you'll find most of my writing and whatnot nowadays. I think that's all I can plug right now. So that's it.
So do you got any retrospectives coming up? Those are very popular.
Yeah, there's a big one coming up. Okay. Odd planning and timing, but we officially started it. And when's this coming out?
Either tonight or tomorrow.
Okay. Well, I'm still gonna hold on to what it is then.
Okay.
Because it's a very exciting one.
All right. I can't wait, and so can a lot of people. Also, can't wait. So
thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can, for my plugins, you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale. You can also follow the show at The Youth Critic for updates and whatnot. And you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHC Network. Please check us out. Leave a comment, subscribe, tell us how we're doing. Tell us if Diego is wrong on everything Alien Covenant.
Absolutely not.
Or tell him that he's absolutely right about Manhunter.
Yes.
But please tell us something. Tell us something. You know, the more comments, the more subscribers, more everything helps us out in the long run. We are going to do a few more retrospectives. We will at some point, maybe like the week of Suspiria coming out, we will do a retrospective on Suspiria and the other two movies in the Three Mothers trilogy from Dario Argento. But we are definitely either next week or the week of the 19th, we are releasing our retrospectives on George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead series, And that will be kind of like our quote unquote franchise we review for Halloween, because who doesn't love George A. Romero's zombie, political zombie movies? But yep. So that is it for the show. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back with you next time.
Help me out.
What are you on?
Believe me, I told you.
Just don't think of it as killing.
Amen.
Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night. It's only ever a question of time.
You nervous? I would be too if I were you. Near Dark.
Could be your boys falling in with control.
Check out time.
Bought yourself some time, son.
God damn, this is my family. Let him go.
Daylight. The night has its price.